You're listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of February 22nd, 2021, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Three legislative aides to Representative Linda Joy Sullivan described their work and observations. Concerns about the emergency housing program in Manchester. This is a partial discussion. To hear the entire discussion, go to the Manchester government page at gnat.tv. And Peru readies for town meeting.
The job of a state legislator is not an easy one or one for the faint of heart. In addition to election campaigns, there's a lot of time spent connecting with constituents and answering their questions. And then comes the work of drafting or reviewing proposed legislation, modifying it and getting it passed through both chambers of the State House. And this year, with the legislature working remotely, it's arguably even more complex. That's where having assistants or legislative aides to help with some of the work is a big help. Representative Linda Joy Sullivan, who represents the district that includes the towns of Dorset, Danby, Mount Tabor, Peru, and Landgrove, introduced us to three of her aides who are working with her this year. One is currently a student from Dorset who is attending Burn Burton Academy. Another is a former student of BBA from Manchester. And a third is a political science major currently attending the University of Vermont. Together in a recent Zoom conversation, they gave us some insights into what the experience is like.
I guess, why don't we just go around our Zoom room here, and we'll start with you, Julia. Tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you wound up being a legislative aide in Vermont.
Well, hi, I'm Julia Brand. I'm a junior at Burn Burton Academy. I live in Dorset. Last year I took an AP Gov class, and towards the end of the class, we had a final that we got to research anything we were passionate about. And I'm super passionate about domestic violence and women's issues. And I reached out to Representative Sullivan, and she was so supportive and so welcoming. And she offered me a position as a legislative aide, and I took it as a great opportunity.
So I've lived in Vermont for most of my life. I'm back here from college because of the pandemic. And I became a legislative aide in November 2019, and I just pretty much did the email version of like cold calling, where I just emailed Representative Sullivan and said, hi, could I work with you? I really like your work. And then we met at the Dorset Bakery. She bought me a chai tea latte, and I have absolutely adored working with her ever since.
It's actually part of a class at UVM. I'm a poli-sci major at UVM, and they have a legislative internship class, and I was assigned Representative Sullivan. But yeah, I feel really lucky that I was assigned with her because I really love her work. And yeah, and I'm sorry if it's loud. I'm on campus right now.
Representative Sullivan, let me turn to you now for a second. How many resumes or communications of one sort or another do you get from people who would like to be a legislative aide?
So actually, I do get resumes and I do get emails. I've been working with interns and legislative aides for many, many years, whether it be as a legislator or in my own profession. And these women are dynamic. These women are so sensible and so passionate, but inarticulate. And they were so eager to jump in on any of the issues because, you know, I go the gamut from, you know, the real hardcore financials number crunching to the social issues. And they understood that, you know, it might not be just the bleeding heart stuff that we're going to do, helping the people all the time. Everything is going to help the people, but sometimes you have to do the tough stuff. And they all were just right there. And every single assignment that I've given them so far made me so proud that these three chose me.
Tell us a little bit about your roles and your jobs and daily responsibilities. Do you sort of divide up tasks and kind of stick to the same basic things, or do you wind up doing a little bit of everything, you know, at some point in the week or another?
I would say my role is just basically completing any projects Representative Sullivan needs me to do. I've done spreadsheets that organize past legislation or current legislation. I've helped with reporter questions and just basically like any mini projects she needs me to complete, I'll do.
I do a little bit of everything. Recently, I've been working a lot on the different pension reform bills that are currently working in the works. And I've just kind of been doing research on that. I've been writing my own memo about that. And then I didn't have an official title. I ended up being the social media manager when Representative Sullivan ran for auditor. And I have to say, doing that, like being part of that campaign, was one of the most fulfilling experiences of my life, and working with the entire team was amazing.
Similar to Julia and Olivia, I'll do whatever Representative Sullivan gives me, but right now I'm tracking bills with like GovTrack and especially on the Vermont General Assembly website to compare to H-193, which is the human trafficking bill, just to see how other states are handling stuff like this. And I'm just tracking bills as they go through committee.
So I'm assuming you're all working remotely. Would that be correct?
I actually haven't been to a legislative building since I was like in sixth grade or something. And I would be super excited to go there once, you know, vaccine rollout is complete and it's safe again. It sounds like an incredible opportunity from what I've heard from different legislatures. But mostly I've always done my work remotely because I go to school in Massachusetts. I just sometimes like casually like break into Representative Sullivan's office in town to steal paper clips or something. That's mostly the office work I end up doing. But we have really great email chains, and I love looking back at all the work we do because it's actually a record of it, and I actually find that quite fulfilling.
So the pandemic has definitely, you know, it's put most of my stuff online, and I'm not a huge fan of that, but I can't really compare it to anything considering I don't know what it would be like if I had to go to Montpelier. But I think I would gain a lot more if I was in person, but that could be said for anything. But since I am in a class, I do get to interact with other legislative aides and other legislative interns and figure out what other representatives are doing through other students in my class. So I think I have that benefit.
So Andrew, they in January, hopefully they will be allowed to come back up there. They've already gotten clearance to be able to come up once we're done with the COVID issues. But they are also interacting not just with legislative aides. They're all interacting with different, based on their projects. Like Mallory could tell you about her interaction with the judicial team, and Olivia with doing her research, and you know, the Department of Financial Regulation, and Julia has an exciting application out there. So you might want to ask them where this is all leading them with their interactions.
Well, you anticipated my next question. I was going to say, you know, what are some of the areas you're all most interested in or find most intriguing? And I guess, Mallory, we'll come back to you then with the, you're involved in judicial questions?
You find? Yeah, so I spoke to Chief Justice. We just spoke about law school. It was a very casual conversation. I want to go on to law after undergrad, and they were really helpful, and they fielded my questions, like whether, no matter how stupid they were, they fielded them, and I really appreciated that. So that was a great networking opportunity for me, and I was really grateful for that.
Yeah, so mostly I've just been calling a huge variety of agencies to try and figure out what everyone's planning to do regarding the public pension issue. And it takes, you know, a lot of perseverance, but luckily this is a small state where the people in office do actually care about the people calling them. So I'm just glad I'm not randomly calling these people living in a state like California, because in Vermont, I do actually feel heard when I'm requesting information. So yeah, it's been good.
To the Children and Family Council for Prevention Programs, and I actually, Representative Sullivan gave me contacts to reach out to multiple individuals who are on the council. And I actually might be finding out today if I'm allowed to kind of swoop in, but I've been going to some Zoom meetings and kind of just giving some input from a student perspective, and it's been absolutely amazing. And I wouldn't have been able to done it without Representative Sullivan. So I'm so grateful for that.
Becoming a legislative aide is a great way to get an inside look at the political process and how it works. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
So I was looking to kind of just get an update. You know, I think we've gotten a lot of emails on the emergency housing program that was designed to be temporary and has become not so temporary. And they, you know, they're troubling and disturbing to me. And I just really want to kind of get an idea of what our timeline is on this and where we are with it.
Ivan, you want me to speak about that?
Yeah, just a little bit in general terms, and I know you've reached out to some individuals, and we haven't received a lot back, but we've gotten some information from the state on this. So yeah, if you could just touch on it, John, just a little bit.
So we, the program was started in Manchester at the start of COVID back in March. It started out really modestly, a dozen people. The program has increased in size to the point where we're sort of tracking it from a perspective of what percentage of participants from town to town, what is their ratio to the overall population of the town. So the number of people that are being housed in Manchester right now are about 121 people. It's the highest ever since the start of the program. That's about 2.75% of the Manchester population. If we get to 131 people, it'll be 3% of our population. So we're seeing big numbers increasing. About 70% of the people being housed in Manchester are at the Chalet and the Econolodge. And then there's some at the Palmer House, some at the Weather Vane, and some at Four Winds. We have had some pretty significant issues with the program. We have seen some influx of drug activity that might be higher than we would see in Manchester otherwise. We've seen some breaking and entering from participants in the program. And we've also seen some firearms issues. We've also seen the some intelligence suggests that we're also seeing out-of-state gang folks show up here in town. So we had a meeting with the state this week with the agency that runs the program. We're going to have another meeting with them next week. So we're going to see what comes from there. There's some zoning issues that we're also worried about. For example, at the Chalet, the occupancy of the units is over two people per unit, with the units being what we think is about 400 square feet. So they've got over two people living in a 400 square foot apartment with just a bathroom and no kitchen facilities. When you look at our zoning and the adaptive reuse, we're talking about long-term residents in a lodging unit. So you're talking about, you know, it's lacking the washing machines. It's lacking any sort of kitchen facilities that would be required in our zoning if it was going to be zoned for housing versus lodging. So right now, we're also meeting with the owner. Both the Econolodge and the Chalet are owned by the same person. We're meeting with them this week. And Ivan, on the water board side, I've had to start looking at the units and say that they've been in use for a year as housing, and there's about 50 gallons a day difference between lodging and residential. So for the Chalet, that would be about a $6,000 water permit fee if we've determined that they're going to be used for residential units versus lodging units. The police department has been involved quite a bit. Captain Owens and Lieutenant Blanchard have done a really good job with it. And I provide the board members an update on the numbers that we're seeing. It's interesting, as a per capita number, like I said, Manchester has about 2.75% of its population. This program accounts for about 2.75% of our population of about 4,300 people. Bennington's numbers are less than 1% of their population. Londonderry has a little bit of units at the Snowden, and Pownall has a couple units at one of their units. But Bennington has the largest number in the county, and Manchester has by far the largest impact as far as the number of people compared to our population. It also, we also sort of question what services are being provided to these people as well. And then the last thing that, you know, we have about 121 people here in Manchester that are being housed. The housing, the homeless surveys that have been done in Bennington County in the past range from about 77 people to 130 people countywide that are homeless. So how we get from a countywide high number of 130 to 121 in one town does seem pretty remarkable, especially when there's prohibitions on evictions. And then the last issue is we also are probably getting our local option sales tax as well. So we're still working through these issues, but we are on top of it. I think the meeting that we had with the state, it was the commissioner and deputy commissioner, I think I would call their response encouraging. And I think they were also kind of surprised to hear about how many people were being housed in Manchester versus our overall population. And the other thing, I guess, Heidi, the last part that I'd mention is we have been tracking the number of calls on these properties from one year to the next. And the percentage of call increases to these properties has actually increased 1,200% in one year. Now, when you come up with a percentage like 1,200%, the first thing you wonder is that this can't possibly be true. And I think the numbers a year ago before COVID, we had about 14 calls between these five properties. Since March to this period now, we have 174 calls for these five properties. So that's a real startling number, a 1,400% increase in call volume.
And what is it as a percentage of the total calls to the police force? What percentage of these calls constitute all their calls that they're getting?
I think it depends how you count it. I think we get about, I'd have to ask the chief. I think we get about 1,500 to 2,000 calls a year. So 174 calls and that's not even in a full year. So that is a pretty heavy call volume.
10%.
What's that? Yeah.
At least 10 to 12%.
Yeah, at the very least, I think you could probably categorize the number of calls we're getting based on the previous as a nuisance. And then the calls do run the gamut. Domestics, you know, we have, I forget how many arrests, but we've arrested, I think, 47 people, or we've made 47 arrests related to the program. People that are living there between, and that's not everything on site either. It includes DUIs, driving license suspended. One of the restaurants in the area of the chalet was broken into three times by the same person, and we arrested the person. But a local business that's nearby was broken into three times.
Report, by the way, John, says that we handled 3,789 incidents.
Is that police or is that police, fire, and rescue? Is that dispatch?
I'm just looking at the police department report, but it could be. But there were 126 overall, 126 arrests. It'd be interesting to find out how many, of those.
Well, you look at that, Greg. We have 47 arrests related to this.
Right. So that's program. Yeah, that's disproportionate year over year.
It is. I mean, it is. I told the commissioner, since I've been here in 14 years, this is the greatest this, and I think Chief Owens agrees with the statement, this is the greatest risk to public safety and public tranquility in Manchester that I've seen in 14 years here.
Before we get to have a look at what's on the agenda for Peru's town meeting, we thought it was time to settle one question. How did the town of Peru get its name? Did it have anything to do with the country of Peru in South America? As it turns out, the answer is yes. When the town was originally chartered in 1761, it was known as Bromley. It didn't become an organized town until 1802. But the name of the town was changed in 1804 to Peru in order, according to Wikipedia, to associate with the South American nation, which at the time was considered a place of great wealth due to the silver mining industry that was based there. It turned out that Peru, Vermont didn't have much of a silver industry, but it did have logging and farmland, and eventually a ski area that restored the name of Bromley. That's settled, and to find out what's up this year for town meeting, we paid a virtual visit with Peru's town clerk, Jenny Freeman, who gave us the rundown.
Anyway, as far as your town budget proposal goes, is there any major changes from last year in terms of the bottom line or what may be in it?
Nothing in the standard budget. We do have, I'm just looking at our ballot right here. We do have one article that was put on the ballot that is different than usual. And it is a request that says, shall the town of Peru vote a sum of money not to exceed $200,000 to construct a multi-use pavilion on the town green? And that is on there because the last 2 years, our fire department, completely on their own, has constructed an ice rink. And this year it was significantly larger than last year's kind of first run. And it is used every single day. It's been an amazing asset to our community. And so that ballot question, though, is that's all it is a question. There hasn't been any real design work done. It's just really to get conversation going and see if the town would get behind the idea of creating some sort of covered space, gathering space for people. So that'll be, I think, a hot discussion potentially at the informational meeting, and we'll have to see if it passes. It's definitely, ideally would be a whole, you know, in-person conversation. But there'll be a lot of good questions, I think, and opportunity to think through it a little bit. So it could pass or it may not because there's a lot of questions, but I think there's so much positive energy circulating around this that there's a chance that it could at least be a jump start. The cost of actually building what, you know, something could be higher than that. But this is a great opportunity to kind of spark people's interest.
And Alessia, do we have any contested races for select board or any of the other town?
Not really. We have some new names, a few, but pretty simple ballot.
Peru will be holding an information meeting by Zoom on Monday, March 1st, starting at 7 p.m. The login information is available on the town's website. All of the town meeting ballots will have been mailed out, with the school district ballots to every registered voter in Peru. Completed ballots are to be returned to the town office, either in the town center drop box or the post office. Voting will still be held on Tuesday, March 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. for those who would like to vote in person at the town hall. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.